Inside the Cross Podcast.
Welcome to the Lacrosse Industry Podcast, a new series that is emerging from the inaugural Lacrosse Industry Summit held Friday, May 27th at the Lowe's, Philadelphia. I am Terry Foy, joined by Dan Flynn. You're back in the saddle, Dan. How's it feel?
Hey, Terry. It feels great to be back in the saddle, riding the podcast with you.
We are going to be shifting gears a little bit. We spent the spring with our podcast listeners talking about the week in college lacrosse. We appreciate all the support. We've been on hiatus as Kyle Devitt and Patrick McEwen have picked up the mantle with a guest appearance by Bob Carpenter, who interviewed Rourke Denver. We hope that you guys were tuning in for all of those, and we hope that you enjoy what we have in store for you. The inaugural Lacrosse Industry Summit was an idea born out of the lifeblood of the company that owns Inside Lacrosse. Inside Lacrosse is owned by a company based out of Charlotte, North Carolina called American City Business Journals. And for those of you that live in 40-some markets across the United States, you might be familiar with the Baltimore Business Journal, the Dallas Business Journal, the Boston Business Journal, and so on and so forth. A big part of that brand's lifeblood, a big part of their identity, is hosting summits for the local business community. We felt like that was something that we could emulate. And so in conjunction with some of the folks at the Sports Business Journal and another company called Leaders in Sport, which is a UK-based company that does some similar event style events that are styled similarly to this business journal event, summit, and symposium, we wanted to bring that to the lacrosse industry as a way of hearing from folks within and outside of our sport some of the different types of best practices that we could implement in order to move the lacrosse industry forward. Dan, you were an MBA. What did you think of the lacrosse industry summit?
Terry, as you are correct. I have an MBA from Johns Hopkins, but also attend a lot of these events more on the college side, some as a SBJ type of events. And the event unfolded very much the way we sort of dreamed it up. And we're very pleased to see that. We had a very fine attendance for the first year, and our list of speakers were enthusiastic, were very knowledgeable, experienced, and provide a lot of value to all of the attendees. And while we are grateful for all of those people participating on the panels, you know, the people who attended too, I think they got a lot out of it. And for that reason, we're going to bring this back. And as a lead up to our next event, we wanted to share a lot of the content that was discussed that day.
Yeah, absolutely. So you hinted at the announcement, but save the date, listeners who are interested in this topic. We will be hosting the second Lacrosse Industry Summit in Baltimore on January 19th, which is the Thursday ahead of the Lacrosse Convention, the 2017 National Lacrosse Convention hosted by U.S. Lacrosse at the Baltimore Convention Center. The location is still TBD, but it will be in Baltimore, and we are excited about the progress that we've made so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you are interested in business and you have an interest in lacrosse, you need to be there. Whether you are involved in almost any aspect of the lacrosse business, I think there'll be something of value for you to take out of that and well worth your attendance and the networking opportunities, Terry, not only with people who are in the lacrosse community, but some of the other leaders and thought leaders in sports and in business that will be attending the second Lacrosse Industry Summit will be of a huge value to all of the attendees.
And that's an important point, particularly because the value proposition of attendance is basically twofold: what you hear and who you get to meet. You have your questions answered, and I think that there's a lot of opportunity there within to continue to develop this industry summit concept that we're very proud of. But as far as the actual content is concerned, we understand that not everybody knew what the Lacrosse Industry Summit was. Not everybody was free and available to attend on May 27th. And so in order to let you understand what it was, what happened that day, as well as what we hope to duplicate going forward, we've decided to share some of the sessions. The day was structured with 7 panel discussions, 2 keynotes, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. And we are going to kick this series off with the morning keynote, which was titled lessons lacrosse can learn from peer sports. I moderated the panel, and the guests were Howard Handler, who's the chief marketing officer of Major League Soccer, Jeff Price, who is the chief commercial officer of PGA of America, and Demora Smith, who's the executive director of the NFL Players Association, as well as the informal title of Total Rockstar.
And all of these guys have some foot in or history with the game of lacrosse, which really helped to add a lot of value and perspective to the program.
Yeah, and Demora's son, Alex, is going through the recruiting process as a high school lacrosse player. Howard Handler was a club lacrosse player at the University of Michigan, and Jeff Price had some experience working with us at Inside Lacrosse in 2014, in addition to having played college lacrosse himself. So we understand and hope that you understand that this is the recording of a live event. So it wasn't structured in such a way that it's optimal for podcast listenership, but we do think that the conversation is very interesting, and hopefully you have a pretty good idea of who's speaking at what time.
Yeah, and really the gist of this was, how can lacrosse benefit from other sports, similar sports? And this panel really examined how sports with similar demographics and markets developed their own growth strategy.
So to steal your phrase, Dan, let's go.
So as I said, my name is Terry Foy. I'm the publisher at Inside Lacrosse. This first panel is lessons that lacrosse can learn from peer sports. There's an aspect of calling us a peer to soccer, football, and golf that may seem aggressive to some, but it is truly the way that I feel. There's so much about the growth that each of these, the organizations that these men represent that we can emulate as a sport. So to begin, I'll introduce Howard Handler is the chief marketing officer of Major League Soccer. Demora Smith is the executive director of the NFL Players Association. And Jeff Price is the chief commercial officer of the PGA. Each of them has a unique connection to lacrosse. They're not here out of the goodness of their hearts. They have an investment in, or solely out of the goodness of their hearts, excuse me. They have an investment in the sport as well. Howard played club lacrosse at Michigan. Demora's son is a high school junior who recently committed to play lacrosse at the University of Hartford. And Jeff played 2 years at Bates and spent some time working with us at lacrosse in 2014. To begin, if each of you could explain, and Howard, we'll start with you, kind of your role within your respective organization within Major League Soccer and what you are tasked with and kind of how your general role fills in with your organization.
Okay. As chief marketing officer at Major League Soccer, my North Star is the development of our fan base. So I obsess over who our fan is, everything that we're doing across the spectrum, commercially, marketing-wise, with our broadcasters, with our schedule, with our player and competition group to make sure that we grow our fan base. Functionally speaking, I oversee our digital team, our promotion, our events, our data, I think that covers it.
Demora Smith, my job is primarily fighting with Roger Goodell. lately, I've been an expert on deflated footballs. My job, obviously, is the head of the union. So whether it's working with the league, we'll generate approximately $12.6 billion in revenue next year, so that for the union head, that means not only looking at the players as the primary generator of resources, but we spend a tremendous amount of time thinking about stadium revenue, television revenue, digital, wearables. My second job is the CEO of a company called Players, Inc. It's our wholly owned subsidiary. Last year, we generated about $160 million of marketing and licensing on behalf of the players. So we're vitally interested in not only the protecting our players, but because every one of them are obviously in it, at least partially, to maximize their revenue, we spend a tremendous amount of time looking at trends and making decisions about what we believe is in the best interest of the players and the best interest of the game.
Jeff Price, the Chief Commercial Officer at the PGA of America, and first I have to say, as a Patriots fan, Dee and Ted Olson are the two favorite guys right now for me. Keeping my fingers crossed that Tom's going to play 16 games. But PGA versus PGA Tour, just so we're all clear. PGA of America owns two of the five biggest events in golf, the Ryder Cup and the PGA Championship, and we represent 28,000 men and women who are the tangible connection between everyone who plays the game at local facilities. So we kind of have a dual focus, and my job is to run that commercial enterprise, our relationships with media, our sponsors, from a digital perspective, a marketing perspective, and really take that revenue that we can drive off our four big events, KPMG Women's PGA Championship, Senior PGA Championship presented by KitchenAid, PGA Championship, and the Ryder Cup, to turn that into programs and initiatives that serve the membership that we have and grow the game. And I spend probably 40 to 50% of my time on Grow the Game initiatives. So spend a lot of time, to Dee's point, doing research, trying to understand trends, understand where parents are thinking, what kids are thinking, and ultimately trying to take a very long-term view for the next 25, 50 years. Where do we take the sport of golf, and how do we get more people playing it for a lifetime?
And to build off that, Jeff, you're relatively new to this position, and it's a relatively new position in its own right. And I think that I want to start with your perspective on taking on a role to help golf grow in the wake of the Tiger Woods, for lack of a better term, bubble, and how you see that reflected in lacrosse's, as I call it, meteoric rise in the previous two decades.
So I think if you go back and certainly think when Tiger came onto the scene in the mid-90s, the sport overall had a huge explosion. The television ratings went through the roof. Attendance at tournaments, certainly things like the PGA Championship, you know, were off the charts. But the sport itself was not ready to kind of welcome a whole new group of players into the game. We didn't have an infrastructure, Terry, to really support the interest. We weren't prepared to put a golf club in lots of kids' hands. We had this kind of gating factor. Golf has always had this position as being elitist and very affluent and somewhat hard to kind of engage. If your parents don't play golf historically, there's less than a 10% chance that a kid was going to play. And so the sport wasn't prepared for all of a sudden this lots of different folks who had never thought golf was cool. Tiger made it cool, but we didn't have an infrastructure to support it. And so while the sport at the upper levels took off, the participation rates among kids did not. And I think we all recognize that was a huge missed opportunity. So from the late 90s to today, what I've seen happen, and certainly in the last 5 years, where we've seen 700,000 more kids playing golf today than were 5 years ago, is a focus from our industry to come together. The USGA, PGA of America, PGA Tour, LPGA, Augusta National, as five leading organizations, we don't have one governing body, but the five came together. We had 88 different programs that were being run and pushed out to the consumer, just completely overwhelming. That's been narrowed down to five. You've got Get Golf Ready, PGA Junior League Golf, Girls on the Course, and the First Tee as the youth-focused four of five initiatives, and that's all we're pushing to the consumer, to parents, to kids, finding a way to get golf into schools, finding a way to put golf clubs in kids' hands, and we're seeing a return on that, a narrowing the focus, and ultimately being able to have a consistent messaging where we've all come together. And I think that's part of what's driving this growth that you're seeing in the sport of golf.
And Howard, to turn this to you, because I think that that's something that soccer experienced as well in terms of not necessarily maybe a narrowing, but also a increased emphasis on collaboration and cooperation. Is that right?
Well, part of our success is the extent to which the league has partnered with the federation and some of the other organizations that care about the game itself. Just to lend some historical perspective, though, the real big bang for soccer in the United States was the World Cup coming in 1994. And that led to the creation of Major League Soccer. We're now 20 years old. But we've tried to work very hard, not just in terms of building a professional league. And at this stage of the game, there's 20 clubs. There's 17 in the United States, 3 in Canada. We've got Minnesota and Atlanta coming online next year, L.A. Soon after that, and hopefully Miami, if David Beckham can do a stadium deal down in Miami. And we've announced that we'll go to 28 teams in the near future. So expansion's an important part of it, but the extent to which we're partnering with the U.S. Soccer Federation in particular, we have an alliance with the third division, USL. We work very closely with the NSCAA, the National Coaches Association. And I think that it's really, really important with as much competition as we have. Soccer has competition not just from the NFL, the NBA, the usual suspects, but, you know, we have the EPL freely available. We have La Liga. We have Champions League. We have Liga MX. So if we really want to grow soccer in this country, there has to be a connection between all the different groups and not politics and infighting, which is hard sometimes. But we work as hard as we possibly can to deliver that. One of the expressions of that is coming up June 3rd. We have the Copa America Centenario that's going to happen in our country, and in Philadelphia in particular, 10 cities, 16 teams. There'll be 32 matches. It's a World Cup-like tournament that pits the nations of North America and South America against one another. And it will be pretty significant. And we couldn't have pulled it off if there wasn't this kind of unified thought around the importance of growing in our country. Now, it was also the catalyst to root out a lot of corruption. And that's still going on. But the positive part of it was that it brought everybody together.
Dee, you mentioned when we were speaking beforehand about there being a couple of points to emphasize as an organization and a sport that's trying to grow, as well as a couple of things to avoid.
Sure.
Do you mind just kind of running through?
Sure. Well, you know, you look at, again, you look at the historical arc of football, and you know, I spend a tremendous amount of time looking at that history in order to think about its future. But I think it boils down to three things for any organization and any business of sport if it wants to grow. Infrastructure is going to be critically important. Businesses like this tend to grow organically. And the problem with growing organically is it tends to grow faster than the infrastructure that's created to utilize it. So that's tends to be a huge problem. Number two is sustainability. Corporations across America, I think, have done a tremendous job over the last 15, 20 years about corporate sustainability. How good are we at being partners in our community? How good we are at being partners with our employees? How do we make sure that those things remain consistent with our business goal, which is a long way of saying that if you're in it just to make money, your business is going to flop. And the last thing is vision. It is very important as sports like this grow organically, as you build infrastructure, to have a vision, to have a North Star of where you want to be at certain stages, because that will prevent you from operating in a dysfunctional way. And you know, just being candid about football, I think there is a certain amount of the business of football that just makes money in spite of itself. You look at where we have gone since the 1960s, whether it's the advent of TV, the merger between the AFL and the AFL, what's happened with the issue of concussions, what happens with the growth or decline of youth participants. If you look at football over the last 10, 15 years, I'm more concerned about our future, our business viability in the future than I ever have been. Lacrosse, I think my main role in lacrosse is buying lacrosse equipment. But, you know, you look at the growth of the sport, I think the challenges for this sport on the youth level is to frankly how to make it more culturally diverse. If that is a goal for you business-wise, you're going to want to have a larger base of people who are not only playing it, but people who just dig it, right? But, you know, you look at things like football and what we're going through with the concussion issue. We don't have a concussion issue in football. We have a confidence issue in football. I mean, frankly, very few parents believe that the game is safe anymore, and that's because they don't trust what's coming out of the National Football League. And so that's inconsistent with growth, right? That's inconsistent with infrastructure. It's inconsistent with sustainability. It's certainly inconsistent with vision.
Can I build on something that Dee said? I think that the diversity issue is really critical to discuss in the context of the lacrosse business. One of the great assets that we have with soccer, yes, it's the world game, and to some extent that creates some built-in advantages. But we work very, very hard to make sure that our entire infrastructure from top to bottom is diverse. On our clubs, we're represented by 55 different countries in terms of our players. Our fan base is very, very multicultural and diverse. And it's a reflection of where our country is. And our country is white and black and Hispanic and Asian and Native American. And that is a challenge for the lacrosse business and something that in order to truly realize its potential, you guys are going to have to come to grips with and really challenge yourselves and think about.
And I would just build on it because obviously golf has had that same challenge. And, you know, the way we're going at it is really on a two-part level. We have 28,000 men and women who are PGA professionals. We need to get that group of folks to look like the rest of America. And we're trying very hard from an, again, infrastructure standpoint to make sure that we're creating opportunities for everyone in America to become a PGA professional if you wanted to be, going out to recruit so that we have 19 schools around the country that run programs to train you to be a PGA professional. We're working very hard with those schools on the recruitment of a much more diverse employment base that we will have, which will then make the folks that walk into the game feel like, hey, this game is welcoming to me. There are folks like me who are a part of the game. And so as a sport, we've taken it not just at the player level, but at the infrastructure level, it has to happen. And it really almost you have to set the pace from a recruitment standpoint among the folks that would be sitting in this room to then make the sport be more welcoming in the inner cities. Run programs like the First Tee and PGA Junior League where we're making sure kids that have never had an opportunity to play the game have an opportunity to enjoy it. And it's not that parental barrier that you had to have a parent who played in order to be able to play the game. But it is a very conscious effort by a sport that for, you know, the better part of 100 years did not do anything, which is why that is such an important challenge for us today.
To pivot a little bit, you've emphasized how important infrastructure is, and this is a general question. Does infrastructure have to be expensive?
No. And I think historically the barriers of entry for every corporation was that it used to be really expensive. But think about it. Media's cheap these days. The people who are really, really good at connecting with individuals on a granular level does not cost that much. Things like growing a sport among different cultures and diversity is just not that expensive. What I think the challenges are is people like all of us are a lot older than all of you. And for every now and then, I think that as I look at our own organization, we're stuck in these traditional ways of how we think businesses have to be built. And I think the challenge or really the opportunity for a sport like lacrosse that is seeing such a tremendous growth from the youth kid level, is harnessing that and providing programs that make it culturally, interesting. But no, you know, infrastructure is just not that important. Now, you know, the larger you get, the more you have to build, but initially it just really isn't. I would view it as a startup.
We've built entire stadiums for less than $100 million. The purpose-built stadiums that have created, there's now 15 of them in our league. You know, some of them are several hundred million dollars, but even with the bricks and mortar side of things, there's kind of scrappier, leaner ways of going about things and still accomplishing something really special.
And that's the perfect transition to the last thing that I wanted to discuss before opening it up to questions, which is one of the things that each of your sports and organizations have in common is incredible spectator and visitor experiences. And for all of the talk about participation, my view is that it's only about half of the growth that we need to attain in lacrosse. The other half is how do you enjoy this game without putting on pads? And so you know, to stick with your point about building stadium-specific or sport-specific, purpose-specific stadiums, that seems to me to have been an enormous catalyst in Major League Soccer's growth, soccer in the United States' growth. How much emphasis does Major League Soccer put on the experience?
Well, I would go as far as to say that our fan experience is really our special sauce. Anybody that's visited one of our stadiums, you know, go to Talon Energy Stadium, Nick Sakevich here built that thing, created one of the great beacons of our sport. You experience an electricity and an energy that is created by the fans. And, you know, we've allowed a supporter culture, to take root. We've given fans specific sections where they can congregate. We've made the pricing very attractive for them. And, you know, we've stripped away a lot of the artifice that, you know, you're accustomed to seeing in an NBA or an NHL game, or even in some, you know, a lot of NFL games where there's music blasting at you and they're telling you when to cheer and everything else like that. We kind of let our fans create the experience in a lot of different ways. A number of our clubs have very tight relationships with their fans. In Seattle, the fans are actually empowered to vote for the general manager of the club, which is rooted in some of the soccer cultures around the world. Can you imagine, right?
Yeah, I'm going to vote a lot.
But the idea is that the fans are at the very center of things, and that relationship is a covenant, and it isn't always perfect, right? You know, some of our supporters like to be disruptive, you know, like to stick it to the man. But for the most part, it's been a good guiding principle for us that's led to a really unique experience in the stadium, and you see it on television as well.
And I guess, you know, for you, DeMorris, it's a little bit of a different kind of manifestation of the role. But how much do you view the experience of the spectator as being integral to what you guys do?
It depends on what the experience is. I mean, look, I grew up, you know, in Washington, D.C. If anybody's been at FedEx Stadium lately, you've noticed that there's blocked off seats all the way around the stadium. We took a lower share, not to go into CBA economics, but we took a lower share of stadium revenue for a reason. We predicted that we were going to see a tremendous spike in television revenue and not so much of a spike in stadium revenue. And I guess the other thing I would say about stadiums, I grew up going to those games with, you know, buddies of mine from high school. When you go to a professional football game now, the one group of people that you see less of is kids, mm-hmm. because it's too expensive. So, you know, I look at all of those issues, obviously I look at them as a CBA revenue issue because that's what I get paid to do. But looking at it from a growth trend, my son won't watch a full football game. It's too long. He'll watch Red Zone. He'll pull up his laptop and he'll track his fantasy team. He'll watch 10 games at once. But the idea of, just for his mentality, of going to a game for 3 hours, there's a whole generation of, I think, young people who that just doesn't fit. So, you know, if you're lacrosse, what do you do about that, thinking 10, 15, 20 years from now, right? So, you know, baseball to me is going to have a very interesting issue. The average viewer of baseball on TV, I think, is somebody in their late 50s.
57.
So if your average viewer is 57 years old right now and you're going to trend of what's going to happen in 20, 25 years, well, you know, that's going to be a pretty long television program, right? Because somebody's not going to make it till the end. So you got to keep it interesting, right? So, you know, when you're thinking about lacrosse, I think there's a tremendous opportunity to make, to do it differently. So, you know, we've always thought about stadium revenue, right? I mean, imagine if you had a college team, whether it's a D1 team or any type of level, where they're traveling around at some point during the year and they're holding a practice or a scrimmage at an inner city high school, right? You know, you take those teams and start putting them in the community and doing scrimmages in different places. Not only do you introduce the game to a whole new group of people, but you're introducing players and the metrics and the speed of the game, and teaching it to a new group of people. So, you know, I think, you know, if I would be tremendously excited, about the prospects. If I'm major league teams, I would be a little bit less excited in trying to figure out how do we hold on to what we have, yeah. Right?
Well, and, you know, Jeff, I understand that the way that you approach your job is, very much about that duality. So obviously
Absolutely.
Your organization is, you know, so invested in these experiential events, but certainly the way that you consume an event live, in person, and the way that you consume an event, through both linear television and digital media, you know, all of that falls under your purview. So how do you approach that challenge?
So it's interesting. If you take golf and you look at whether it's the PGA Tour week in and week out, take our PGA Championship or even the Ryder Cup, the physical manifestation of the event, in the best case scenario, is going to make a few million dollars, just the expense of putting it on. But the opportunity that we have from a media perspective to drive significant revenue that is really funding the initiatives to grow the sport, everything that we do with the PGA of America, with the Ryder Cup and PGA Championship, is ultimately about taking those dollars back and putting them to work in our sport. We're not for profit C6, 501c6. So it's not about driving top line revenue to put into the pockets of an ownership group. It is ultimately about how do we take those initiatives, how do we take those events and help them drive revenue that will grow our sport. We're also able, you know, we don't have that problem. You go to a golf tournament, you're going to see lots and lots of kids. That's because for most events, Ryder Cup and PGA Championship included, if you're under 16, you're going to be able to get in for free. Mm. So you see lots of kids at golf tournaments. All of a sudden, they're following, they're walking around with flat-billed hat like Ricky Fowler's wearing. They're wearing head-to-toe Under Armour because they want to look like Jordan Spieth. They want to be the next Lexi Thompson on the LPGA Tour. And so you're seeing kids relate to golfers because they're seeing them in media. They're seeing them in video games. They're seeing them on social media. And all of that is helping, I think, to propel our sport forward and make it cool. Because mm-hmm. kids want to do what ultimately is perceived as cool. The last thing that I just wanted to share in terms of PGA Junior League golf, everyone thinks of golf as an individual sport. What we recognize is that we needed to bring the team aspect that lacrosse has in spades, right? That it was kid to kid sharing that golf was cool that's helping to grow our sport. So you've got that opportunity. You've got lots of ambassadors in the kids who are playing. You need to help them to facilitate the growth peer to peer. It isn't going to come from parents or adults telling kids that something is cool. This is something you want to do. What we're seeing is kids are telling other kids, golf is fun. Hey, we're having a great time. Put a uniform on. Wear a number just like in any other sport. And come play. And we're seeing success with that. I think lacrosse has such a great upside. I think part of what ends up happening is what I've seen from the outside is everyone's going for what is right in front of me today.
Right.
And it's about my quarterly earnings or what ultimately is going to happen on a year-to-year basis. Much of the way your infrastructure is set up, for-profit businesses that really need are trying to scrape to get by and grow. So everyone kind of holds everything close to the vest. If there's one point that I would make is you need to put that aside for a bit and say, how do I take a 5-year vision, a 10-year vision of where we want our sport to be and collaborate? You're going to compete, but ultimately you have to collaborate to grow.
Well said. 100%.
And I think that that's a nice transition to Soccer United Marketing as an entity. Can you explain a little bit about what that was and how it came to be?
Yeah, I mean, it builds off of Jeff's point of collaboration and vision, and same thing that Dee said. What we were noticing was that we would go in and try to sell Major League Soccer, and we would bump into somebody who was trying to sell Mexican soccer or FC Barcelona or, you know, you name it. And we knew that we were too small to kind of build the game in a fragmented type of a fashion. And so part of this came out of one of the challenges, you know, leagues kind of grow and they plateau and sometimes they take a sideways turn and you know, after 2000, 2001, you know, our league had to shut down a couple of clubs. So there was a little bit of a backdrop that's, you know, not worth going into too much detail on. But the idea was, hey, you know what? Let's band together. Let's figure out a way to sell properties in conjunction with Major League Soccer. There was a very bold move on our commissioner's part to acquire World Cup rights. And so therefore, the basic idea is let's unify and sell around a category. And to this day, we have a commercial company called Soccer United Marketing, and we represent the U.S. Federation, the Mexican Federation. We represent the CONCACAF Gold Cup. There are additional rights that we're acquiring. And what it allows us to do is to make a unified offering to corporate America, to have relationships with stadiums and municipalities that relates to presenting games and tournaments so that we can be as big as possible.
Hey, Howard, just one point, because I've always found it interesting. Soccer United Marketing also had a long-term vision and was able to bring a partner with Deep Pockets in Providence to come in. And you know, the sound business that you ultimately built and bringing capital to work really has enabled you to do some interesting things. And kind of interesting, I've heard lots of different conversations in lacrosse where money is looking to come into the sport, but no one on the money side can see an idea that's big enough or has a long enough horizon to necessarily say, hey, we're going to go all in. But it's interesting, you guys were able to accomplish that and really build a long-term business model.
Yeah, so Providence Equity made a fairly substantial investment in the business about 5 years ago at this point. So it was, you know, several years after the creation of Soccer United Marketing, but they basically looked at the intrinsics of the sport, the structure of our league, the structure of our business, and felt like they could really, really help us grow. And so they took a share of the company, invested pretty significant growth equity, and it really led to some of the more recent investments that you may have seen if you pay any attention to soccer in some of the big world-class players, the Kakas, the David Villas, these big world-class players, because we had more money. It's just the plain truth.
Dee, you mentioned how important the rise of television was for the NFL and how consumable it is. But as you and how you guys bet on that in the last collective bargaining agreement, how do you predict that same development unfolding as it relates to digital media and your properties, whether they be actual games, highlights, or other associated content being conveyed digitally?
The digital platform or the digital opportunity, better said, is limitless because it's only bound by what ideas people come up with about how to consume the game. So, you know, one issue that we are looking at very hard is this issue of wearable technology, sensors. You think about a world where, you don't have to look far in the National Football League to know that their view of marketing is, while the games are being played between August and February, their goal is literally world domination. And so whether it's a property that's being created of the draft or a property that's being created of the combine or these ridiculous regional combines that they're trying to sell to people, the real thing on the verge of exploding is can people track and know what athletes are doing through wearable technology? Can I train like a cornerback for the Giants? Can I bench like a guy from the Eagles? So, you know, all of a sudden that now means that there's revenue that's being generated wholly and separate from the game. So you don't have the expense or the overhead of putting those things on, and you're also equally important capturing people's attention during other hours of the day. So, you know, again, on the lacrosse side, I look at it as a tremendous opportunity. I mean, thinking about my own son, nobody cared, you know, on his team of who he committed to. They all cared that he had the fastest shot, right? You know, and that's cool to a kid. So imagine a world where there's sensors on the sticks and sensors in the balls, and you have a sensor on the goalie's chest so you feel the impact of what happens when a ball hits him, and it can be measured. Those are the kind of things that are going to really have an outsized return on your investment. And again, looking at lacrosse as this thing that is only going to evolve, building that infrastructure so that you can capture the organic movement of the game is something that's going to be really exciting to watch.
Well, and Howard, I think that is interesting because I remember a time when soccer on TV was criticized because there were no commercial breaks. Its ceiling was artificially low because of that. I think now it's billed as a selling point because it fits into a predictable window. There's very little fear of it stretching over. And the reason I bring that up in relation to Dee's point is I think people say things about lacrosse like it's hard to follow the ball, I don't understand the rules, etc. But is the point that you're making that because we're at this kind of tipping point, there are opportunities in the digital space to build up?
Grab the athletics of it, you know, and I think that's what you're seeing, that at least on the football side, that's becoming very interesting. I mean, I don't watch a lot of football. I know that'll make the news, but I just have other things to do. But, you know,
it takes too long.
But, you know, you look at, you know, these graphics now that are tracking how fast the running back is running, right? And those things are being inserted into the game, not only to help the viewer follow the game, but to monetize what's coming from this sensor technology. So we're already seeing it, you know, being applied in football in order to keep your attention. You know, I think the real issue for lacrosse is going to be how do you take those things that are organically happening in other sports and start thinking about using them as structural ways to grow the sport without using commercials as your primary source of revenue.
I think that's a great point. I we are right in the middle of an unbundling of media.
Yeah.
And we're moving very, very quickly towards an over-the-top world. One of my personal complaints as a former player and as a guy who understands and loves lacrosse is nobody's really figured out a way to capture it properly on a screen. And I think that all the means exist for experimentation and to try to figure it out. Some of the stuff that Dee's talking about with wearables, but just digital technology in general, creates a huge opportunity for you guys. And on some levels, you're a little bit unburdened in the same way that some of the other sports are historically. You know, most of us are still really, really dependent upon rights holders overpaying for our properties. And I don't know how many more years that's going to happen. And so to the point of, hey, listen, sponsorship needs to be a player and needs to play a role. That doesn't mean there has to be commercial breaks. You can embed sponsor messages. You see the creative things that happen in soccer with clocks and wraps and different types of things. That's great. But figuring out how to sell subscriptions, figuring out a way to get your most impassioned fans to say yes, I care about this club or I care about this college and I want to follow it and I want to watch it is really, really important. But I would say, and it's incredible because, you know, Syracuse is such a power within the lacrosse world, figure out a way to get those media experts to get in a laboratory and to figure out a better way to present the match, the matches on a square screen. That has big upside. I'm sure Michigan's willing to help. Just saying.
I guess kind of building on that, Jeff, how there are two components to what was just brought up. The idea of reliance on an infrastructure of rights and sponsorship. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's analogous between lacrosse and golf is the size of the endemic sponsorships. Folks that are particularly equipment manufacturers within the sport who provide so much sustainability for the sport. How has golf approached the idea of, uniquely incorporating those folks, as well as building off of the digital and technological opportunity.
So there's, I think, a unique difference between our sports. Obviously, the endemic manufacturers, from a golf perspective, have a lifetime value of the consumer that is significantly greater. You can play golf till you're 80, 90 years old. And so I think there's been a longer-term horizon from the endemics in golf. We've been able to get, with PGA Junior League Golf, all of the endemic manufacturers to step in and play nice in the sandbox. Work together, understanding that if PGA Junior League and these youth programs grow, we build lifelong golfers, we then have an opportunity that they can be monetized for many, many years to come. Lacrosse has a different challenge. You've got a much more condensed lifespan of the actual participants. So I think it's apples and oranges as it relates to the endemics, but I will tell you, it wasn't necessarily easy to put everyone in the room and get them to want to collaborate on Junior League. We had some tough conversations, but at the end of the day, we were able, again, with a 5- and 10-year plan, to get folks who haven't ever played together to work and really try and build something that was sustainable. We had to make a commitment that we weren't going to run a different marketing program out to grow the game, which is one of the PGA's, you know, great mistakes over many, many years. Put another flashy slogan together, and that's what was going to grow the game. We had to commit to something that we said, hey, we're making a 50-year investment in this platform. We're going to grow this to be a global platform. And then the endemics really all came in and got behind us. I think as it relates to the television world, you know, Howard said it well. Right now we're at a divide, right? Marquee events that scale are continuing to show significant growth. Where you're seeing the challenges is on the periphery. If you're not scaling an audience, it's very difficult. It's almost self-perpetuating. It's more difficult from the traditional sense to get that airtime, to get the exposure that then basically in perpetuity, you're kind of either growing in stature or you're not visible. So I think from a lacrosse standpoint, this is your biggest weekend on television, right? This is the pinnacle, no disrespect to the professional league, but right now this is the pinnacle of your sport as it relates to a television audience. I don't think there's enough behind this. I drove into town yesterday. I could see banners and things for Copa, and I could see other events that were going on. It didn't feel, driving into Philly, like this was the pinnacle of your sport, the pinnacle. It just, there wasn't a sense of bigness. That's all something that you all can control. You can make your biggest event bigger, or you can create other opportunities. You know, the Ryder Cup is something that nearly died in 91 and is now a pinnacle event for our sport on a global basis. It does take some thinking through how do you create the stature of your biggest events so that they do grow and they create that opportunity. Because it's going to be a haves and a have-not world, whether it's an over-the-top solution or ultimately the continued rights world that we've been living in. Those big platforms are going to generate revenue. Those that are small and perceived to be small will struggle.
Do you mention that you don't watch a ton of football? What do you think of lacrosse on TV?
I think let me rephrase. I just don't. But go ahead. Sorry.
What do you think of lacrosse on TV?
I think it's great. I mean, now I think the difference though is, you know, I've got that connection because, frankly, he's bigger than me now and can't turn the channel. But, you know, I think that what it means though is how, you know, piggybacking off of this, I mean, and it's obviously a different scale, but, you know, when you, head to the Final Four for basketball, it is a bigness of epic proportions, right? And so I think, whether it's TV or you know, what happens around an event, I think that you have to scale large because that event, it really becomes more of a marketing driver, right, than sometimes even a revenue driver.
That's right.
And you have to have that level of marketing. I mean, there is something cool and interesting about lacrosse because it's still sort of a club and I hate sort of the bro culture, but that whole thing among kids is very cool. But I think what you have to figure out how to do is how to grow that sort of organic feeling love of lacrosse, make sure that it's not culturally exclusive, right? But build on it. And that there is an opportunity there. And you know, part of it is making sure that, and I'm gonna, again, I live my life pissing a lot of people off, but you know, this, you have to get away from coaches who dominate the business. And that's one significant change that happened in football in the mid, you know, I would say probably late 60s, early 70s. You know, this idea that, that coaches controlled it, from a business standpoint, that's not what they do, right? And so bursting through onto that next stage is when, you know, back in the 90s, for example, when football made the huge jump on properties, that wasn't a coach driven exercise, right? And so there was a lot of tension. But the only way that you can start to grow this sport is to start viewing it as, how well of a job do you do in making it into a digestible commodity? The last thing I would say about it though is don't make the mistakes that football made. If I were, in this business right now, I would be doing everything I could to reassure every parent that we are keeping your kids safe. And start that now, because the tragedy of football will be, and the reason why you're seeing such a dip in youth participation of football is not because there's a concussion issue. It's there's a trust issue. And if you are able to do that and make sure that you're instilling all of the protocols and the safety things, all the things that coaches typically don't like, right? You will build your sport and you won't be subject to, the pitfalls that I think that we're in right now.
Do you think that the effort that the NFL is undertaking right now is, good just too late? Or do you think that there are still things that, cause I guess I asked from the perspective of, is it emulatable?
They're terrible at it.
Okay.
They're just awful. Look, you know, we spent a lot of time collectively bargaining protocols and protections, but you know, I can say Case Keenum. Everybody saw that guy wallow on the field last year, obviously in distress, and they left him there. I mean, if you say the words NFL and NIH, what comes to mind right now? Well, you can put in all the protocols and talk about heads up football, but when people are seeing on TV that the NFL tried to steer and influence, you know, NIH's research, what does a parent take away from that? The takeaway isn't that there's a concussion problem. The takeaway is there is a trust problem. So that's where I think that sports, you know, on that organic rise, it is so easy to start doing things now so that you don't make those mistakes. I mean, thankfully, Roger and the people at the league office have given you a pretty good roadmap of how not to do it. Put that on a wall and just say, don't do that. Now you know why we have such a wonderful relationship.
And I want to open it up for questions in just a couple minutes, but, just in kind of a summation, I suppose, you mentioned obviously, what you would be doing if you are in this room as an attendee, being involved in the lacrosse industry. I'm curious for you, Howard, and for you, Jeff, what do you see as being the most important things that lacrosse should be doing right now?
I think having a long-term vision of where you're trying to go, I think it's really important that the leaders of your business, of your industry, of your sport are kind of unified in understanding where you want to go and that you've built a plan to get there. That may sound pretty simple, but I think it's really important. The other thing that I would say is that you must obsess over your fan. You must really understand exactly who they are, what makes them tick, why they care, what might be troubling to them, but also understand who are the people on that bubble just outside of that? Because right now there is a fantastic core. You never, ever want to lose that core. But your challenge is to figure out a way to scale and to start to cross over and to start to bring, you know, more people into the mix. All the great businesses of the world that we can think of today, you know, the Apples and the Amazons, never forget to think about who their customer is and how they can please them.
And I would just say the race to the recruiting solution or the payday of recruiting being the end-all, be-all for the sport will be the thing that drives you into the ground.
Yep.
This has to be about kids having fun and enjoying the sport. If you want to build a fan base, you ultimately want as many people as possible to know how to throw a lacrosse ball, how to catch a lacrosse ball, have an understanding of the sport. If the entire ecosystem is set up for a freshman to try and get recruited to play in college, boy or girl, you've missed the mark.
Yeah.
You've got to ultimately make this fun for kids, have them enjoy the sport, have them become part of your culture for life. They may not be able to play for life, but they can be fans for life. And I think that's where this sport kind of misses it. There's so much focus on that early recruiting, on the scholarship as the end-all, be-all. It's got to be fun for kids to play, and that needs to be a focus again of the sport, not the pinnacle of the scholarship.
Excellent. Round of applause for these guys. I believe we have between 15 and 20 minutes for questions, so hopefully the multiple prompts and reminders had people writing a few down. Dan's got a microphone that he'll bring to you if anybody has.
Dan Matthews from Lacrosse Talk Radio. Howard, this question's for you. How do you identify that fan base, and how diverse is the fan base from sport to sport?
We're pretty geeked out when it comes to that. Data is a big part of what we're trying to manage. It's really important that we capture records every opportunity that we get. So anybody that comes into our stadium, we know who they are. They get added to a big centralized data warehouse. I was at the NFL in the 90s. When I got to MLS in 2014, it kind of blew my mind that we had this single entity model and that the owners were more incented to cooperate with one another. And it didn't take a lot of selling to get everybody to agree to create a centralized data warehouse. So that means that every club throws all of its data into one big entity. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, New York can steal Philadelphia's data. There's all kinds of work to protect people and you know, to manage the integrity and so on. But in putting everything together, we have a very high level of addressability. You know, one of the things that I was frustrated when I was at the NFL, also when I was at MTV, is that we were separated and disintermediated from our fans. It was, you know, cable operators that had the end relationship with the fan. It was, you know, retailers, sponsors, you name it. It was everybody but the entity ourselves. And in a digital connected world, we have the ability to have that relationship. So that's an important aspect of it. And we do all kinds of research. And then, as I said earlier, on a more local basis, our clubs have relationships with their fans. They sit down with supporters. For the most part, it's a really good thing. Sometimes it can be really challenging. Just ask Nick. But, you know, we make it a point to really listen hard and to invest in all the modern tools and technologies so that we have great insights.
Additional questions?
Hey, guys. We talked a little bit about big international events being keys to whether it's the Ryder Cup and obviously the World Cup. Lacrosse has the World Games, but from your knowledge, is lacrosse doing enough to potentially grow internationally? Should we make an Olympic run? Should we try to somehow come together with Ryder Cup-like ideas for lacrosse on the international side? What's your feeling on that, probably starting with Jeff?
So you have an event that kind of I would put back to where the Ryder Cup was late 80s, early 90s, that was teetering. And, you know, we did a few things in partnership with NBC back in the early 90s that really kind of catapulted that event. And, you know, one of the key moves was Europe going from just Great Britain and Ireland to all of Europe. And that changed the nature of interest from a global footprint standpoint in the event. And so I do think first start with what you have and figure out, is there an opportunity to dial that up? The Olympic question is something each sport has to look into on its own. We obviously are going back into the Olympics this year. You've heard some of our players say they're, you know, concerned. There's obviously issues in Brazil and things on a personal nature that they may not want to participate. The schedule's really tight. We think it's great on a global basis to grow the game, but I think each sport has to look at the Olympics as where does it fit and how much of a catapult will it be to grow the sport around the world. We think it's a really good thing because countries that have never cared about golf now think, hey, there's a medal opportunity. So China, as an example, hopefully changes their mindset about golf as being something that the government pushes away to something that they're embracing. So if you're going to take the Olympics, you really have to think about it on a global growth scale. How does it fit in to what your sport is doing? And what, back to the long-term strategic plan, where does that fit in on the roadmap of things that you could do?
Howard, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I guess the, you know, I don't know the real answer to the question. I don't know how many great lacrosse nations there are around the world and if that's, you know, really an interesting competition. I will say that as much as we have built the professional game of soccer here in the United States, and this even goes for the English Premier League and the Mexican League, when our games are televised, we get hundreds of thousands of viewers. And that's good. You know, we're going to continue to grow it. That's why, you know, that's why guys like me have a job. But when the U.S. men's national team plays or the U.S. women's national team plays, there are millions of viewers. And so if it is a catalyst for people to really understand what's special about lacrosse and if it is the pinnacle of the game, then yeah, maybe it's got some interesting potential. And I would also go back to some of the things that Jeff was really articulate about in terms of the value of big events and really galvanizing all kinds of activity to focus on one thing, which this Final Four does definitely represent, is can it be that? Can you get everybody to rally together to do that? So I think it's a lot of good, you know, kind of soul searching and questions that you need to go through to ultimately have a good answer to that.
And D, you can speak to this in the sense that lacrosse and football are predominantly North American sports.
Right.
So how important is international growth to the NFL and the NFLPA?
I would piggyback on what was said. Two big questions. Where does it fit in your vision? Right? I mean, we talked about coming into Philadelphia and we don't feel the bigness of lacrosse here, right? So, you know, you have the wonderful opportunity of reminding people about how connected this sport is to Native Americans and America, right? So, I mean, it seems to me that on the scale of things and where the international piece fits, you know, you almost look and question whether or not you've maximized your opportunities here first and then export it. That's what I would be thinking about.
That's a good thought.
Okay.
Question? This is Tom Gibson with Gibson Communications. Heading into the weekend with the NCAA championships, and you're talking about perception and fan perception as far as when you're viewing on television, and also empty seats being in too big of a stadium. I've read about it in Inside Lacrosse and everywhere else that maybe we've grown too quickly from the perspective of trying to be in too big of a stadium. And Howard, you were talking about the building of smaller stadiums that do fill to capacity like Red Bull Stadium. Do you ever see an opportunity for soccer stadium, the smaller soccer stadiums, to come into the fray with lacrosse so that when the TV cameras are on, there are more people in seats, as we say in PR, you know, see more butts, and trying to come across, you know, it builds an intensity. When you turn on the TV set, no matter where the camera goes, the stadiums are, the seats are full and builds a perception like, wow, this is a growing sport. There's not a seat in the place versus going to a bigger box stadium where we are now. It's still going to be a challenge to have that perception come across that this is a huge event.
Yeah. I mean, it's really bad when you watch what is billed to be a big event and you're not seeing a real rocking crowd and a full stadium. I mean, full stop. No other way to explain it. That was our belief in terms of building stadiums that were, 15 to 25,000. And it's interesting, 20 years into it, now we're starting to build stadiums that are going to be a little bit bigger than that. But the principle is concentrate the excitement. But this is something that everybody struggles with. It's really, really interesting. We're fortunate to have relationships with some of the leagues and federations around the world. One of the things that La Liga, the Spanish league, is doing, is they are actually going to fine, clubs that have empty sections of seats that are within view of television. That'll get an owner's attention very quickly.
Do you think the Final Four would be able, do you think an MLS stadium like Red Bull would host the Final Four?
Oh, for sure. I mean, there's already, at Dick's Sporting Goods Park in Colorado, there's La Crosse that's played there. And I think Talent Energy is hosting the women's championship. What a fantastic venue. It's great for fans, man, because they're closer. I mean, big football stadiums are built for football. Sometimes, you're gonna see these big Copa America events. You're gonna get to see some of these great, national teams of the world. But those stadiums were not built for soccer. And I'm sure that it's even more challenging, for a game that I think requires a little bit of intimacy like lacrosse. So I definitely think it's good. We hate having, different lines on the field and some of the Texas, Houston and Dallas, play some college football games and then we have to see football lines, which hurts our authenticity a little bit. I think lacrosse played in some of our purpose-built stadiums is plenty cool.
Test 1, 2, 3. Mike Poppleton, All-American Face-Off, All-American Draw. Just a quick question about, talking about the relationship between stadium attendance and digital media and really kind of your, I guess, vision and your outlook, to it over the next 5 years and 10 years.
Well, crassly, I think one's going to grow and one's going to decline. And the goal, at least in football, and I think the goal for any sport who wants to grow is to make sure that both grow, right? So I think that the fun thing is that when it comes to the digital side, there's certainly a lot of things in common, but the opportunities on digital are endless. The opportunities on stadium, I think, are somewhat constrained, right? And for a sport that's growing, more people need to come to a lacrosse game who don't have a son, daughter who played lacrosse, right? I mean, that, just to put it in a crass functional box, it has to be entertaining outside of, am I going to get the coupon to Dick's, I think that's the challenge for lacrosse from a stadium event side. On the digital side, I would love to be in that space right now, except for the multiple pieces of competition.
Right.
I mean, you've got hundreds of people doing all sorts of different things across the country. Trying to figure out a way to get your hands around that from a, from a collaboration side is, I don't envy that. But the idea of coming up with a digital platform for lacrosse that cuts across is amazing, right? And so, for us, we're still in that stadiums drive. I mean, owners like big stadiums primarily because they want to build skyboxes. That's where they make their money. So, you know, the fewer number of fans that start coming to football stadiums, it's not going to hurt until it starts hitting stadium, you know, custom box, side. You know, I think the challenge for lacrosse on the stadium side is just that one real crass challenge. How do you make somebody come who didn't play, doesn't have a son who played, doesn't have a daughter who plays, right? Why is it going to be entertaining? So I think thinking about, you know, whether you start using amplifiers to pick up things on the field and broadcasting it out to the fans who are in the stadium is a really interesting thing. I just came up with that. I'm going to trademark it right away. But you know, things that make the physical, the physicality of the game interesting. You know, this whole thing of even miking up coaches so people can hear them in the stadiums is a way that, you know, it happens on football, right? But you need it in lacrosse because you need somebody to actually explain what's going on. That's how I look at it.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, the world take golf. I'm spending a ton of time right now thinking about how digital will enhance the fan experience. For any of you that have been to a golf tournament, if you're sitting on the 18th hole waiting for the play to come to you, it can be incredibly boring. Like, all right, let's get to some action, and you get, you know, five groups that come through. That it's great, but you get a long day there. So we are working, and this is where I think the sponsorship world has evolved. So the conversations we're having now with some really interesting companies is not about kind of just brand visibility, but it's how do they help us to completely change the fan experience? And how do we take those 18 different stadiums that we ultimately have in golf and turn each of them into a really interesting event as play is happening? And that's where digital and fans come together. And that's totally unique to our sport. Football had fantasy football, to the point you made earlier, that made the digital engagement that much greater. What is it in lacrosse that is your unique sauce that you have that can make that in-stadium experience better? I don't know what it is, but I think you have to look at each sport is going to find its own kind of equilibrium as it relates to digital. You got to get those insights from fans, from spectators, and then turn that into making it more fun for somebody who doesn't understand the game to come to a game.
I guess kind of building on that confluence of digital and in-stadium experience, are you guys believers in virtual reality and the virtual reality, the VR consumption over the next 10 to 15 years?
I had a good joke, but I'm going to let it go. I don't know anything about virtual reality.
It's early days. Everybody's experimenting. We'll see what happens. I mean, I think it's a shiny object right now.
Right.
Doesn't mean you shouldn't, you know, experiment with it. But I think, you know, having that intimate relationship with fans is really important. I think you asked a great question. I think it's very age old. In terms of kind of building sports and teams and properties, it does have to begin with attendance. You know, it's funny. We're in a different life stage. You know, we have figured out a way to create a great live experience and product and are working really, really hard to scale up our media platform and, you know, television ratings and all the rest of that. And the NFL is in a place where they're so priced, and the experience is so long that it becomes challenging for people, you know, to kind of justify that. You guys are in a completely fresh situations where you can go, okay, how are we, you know, you got to think like Starwood, you got to think like Disney. How are we going to make this the place to be? And for people to refer and to tell their friends, you gotta come, this is the most incredible thing. You guys have a clean slate, you have the opportunity to do that.
Can we mic up these athletes?
We're miking up our guys. I know we have an important union leader here, and the players have something to say about that. But we think that it's creating incredible content. You know, all you have to do is watch some of these recent NBA games and, you know, you see what's happening in the locker room, the huddles, all the rest of that stuff. That's letting people go to places that is, you know, just your regular Joe off the street that they've never been able to experience. So it's pretty powerful stuff, I think.
So building on the point that DeMore's just made, obviously participation, linking to fandom makes sense, but at a PGA event or an NFL game or an MLS game, there's a significant amount of the fan base that didn't necessarily play the sport. So how do you think about communicating and selling your sport to the people who didn't play it or didn't have kids that played it?
Yeah, I think that's a challenge. I mean, it comes down to, you know, I don't mean it in a crass way, but it comes down to the entertainment side of it, right? Why is it going to be, well, a better question. How am I going to make this entertaining? And I think that is a real challenge. I think, like any sport, the answer is somewhat rooted in the physicality of the sport. I mean, why do we want to go see people who can do things that I can't do, right? And how do I make that exciting? And whether it's miking up, athletes, whether it's amplifying what's going on the field, whether it's, providing some sort of, feedback, whether it's, from a sensor or from a perspective that a fan can watch. But I think that's the challenge. And I think, it's not intuitive. And I think frankly, anybody who loves the sport because they played it or have a kid who played the sport is probably not the person to answer the question.
But can I say that for soccer, and I'm sure that there's some application for lacrosse, we've learned from Electronic Arts that there is almost as high of a likelihood of becoming a fan from playing FIFA, right, as there is actually playing the game of soccer itself. And soccer's pretty easy to play, you know. All you have to do is you know, mound up some trash or some socks or whatever, and you got a ball and you got something to kick around. So it's very easy to experience the game firsthand. But we're seeing in a modern technology-driven world that gaming is an enormous, enormous driver. So I don't think that playing is a prerequisite to being a fan and to kind of having that kind of tribal connection to what's going on.
And I'd ask the group here, which sport are you more likely to be a fan of lacrosse if you like that other sport? Who could tell me?
Hockey.
What are you doing to market to hockey fans the idea that you are the extension of that sport? I mean, as an industry, if that's the correlation, and those are the folks that are probably the lowest bar in terms of creating entertainment and relevance to,
yeah,
what are you doing to reach those fans to bring them into your sport? And those are the kind of things, as you build that long-term plan and think holistically, you got to put some dollars and resources against folks who are going to be the lowest bar in terms of bringing them in.
Well, and here's the flip side. When I go into D.C. or go back to my old high school, do you know how I sell lacrosse? It's basketball with a stick, right? It's backdoor passes. It's seeing the cuts. It's having a great point guard who can move off the ball. This is the world that, I mean, these are the stages of how to figure that out, right? And again, I think it's, I mean, to be in that position is just fun, because you get to build it.
This is a great discussion. We have time for a couple more questions.
Benjamin Parker here. Mr. Smith, this question's for you. You mentioned you fight with Roger Goodell on a regular basis.
Really? Is that news?
Yeah, no, I'm like, what time is it? It's my job.
Most of the major sports have that problem, really. Historically, it's always adversarial between the players' union and the ownership group or the players' union and the leagues. As lacrosse grows and hopefully the money with it, how do you create a partnership with the players' union? Or is it a necessary evil?
No.
Is that always the case?
Well, I don't think it's a necessary evil. I mean, I think, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool, hardcore organized labor guy, so you'll always have the tension between labor and management, right? But going back to this world of building it, you have a wonderful opportunity to make your players true partners in building this, right? And so there isn't a tremendous amount of money now. So I would think about four or five things to make your players partners now, so that you would trend in the right direction. And it pretty much starts off not treating your players as fungible commodities, right? I mean, if you go to your players and you make sure that if they get hurt, they're going to get health care, right? I mean, if you make sure that they can have the opportunity to grow as the business grows, those are the kind of things that will make it easy for whether it's your college teams or your professional teams to want to spend time in other jurisdictions trying to build the game, right? Giving them a long-term view of, you can actually remain connected with lacrosse after you're a player and you can't play anymore. We can bring you back as an investor. Those are the kind of things that would have been very cool and smart to do in the 1970s. But if you don't do it that way, especially on the issue of health and safety, if you don't do it that way, it will be antagonistic. And yeah, I mean, there's a part of me that actually digs it. But look, we have a share of revenue deal. I mean, so the reason why we have such big fights with the National Football League is we are not on a salary scale. We keep about 50 to 48% of the revenue we generate. And so that tension then becomes over how we share the pie. Make them a part of building the pie.
And if one of your star players has an equipment violation, don't turn it into a federal case.
You know, I need you to write an op-ed for us soon. But thank you. Thank you. This was awesome.
I'm sorry. Do you mind if we just stick around for two more? All right.
Andrew Manning with Rabel Lacrosse. One of the things you never really hear about is the relationship between the NFL, the NFLPA, and the NCAA. From the outside, it seems like a synergetic relationship where both kind of feed into each other's growth. I'm wondering if that's true and how a professional lacrosse league can sort of build that same relationship.
Yeah. There is a tension, you know, obviously between the union and the NCAA. I mean, I think, and again, honestly, I think this is something that on the college level that the NCAA is going to have to figure out really quick. Because, you know, it just seemed, and I don't know whether it's a creature of social media. I mean, you were in the NFL back in the 90s, but, you know, both athletes and parents feel far more empowered now, than I think before. That sponsors are now, you know, sponsors who care about sustainability and who have boards who care about sustainability are far more sensitive to any view that they're partnering with an entity that doesn't treat people well. And so, you know, you might not see that the partnerships between, you know, the insurance companies and the NCAA go from this to zero overnight. But what is going to happen over a period of time is, I think you brought it up, how much are they going to overpay? And all of these sports, and particularly football and the NCAA, have benefited from sponsors overpaying for a number of years. At some point, that's going to start to creep back. So, you know, we support and have supported the unionization effort for college players for all sorts of reasons. But I think from a business macro standpoint, they're going to have to make a decision real quick about how are we going to grow and are we going to grow if there's going to be increased tensions between the rights of athletes and the rights of management.
Last one to new NLL Commissioner Nick Sakevich.
Yeah, hi, Nick Sakevich with the NLL. Gents, we have a fragmentation in our business, and I'm probably likely correct in that most people coming here this weekend do not know about our league. We're the indoor version of it. And in my 3 months here, I've noticed that there's a deep fragmentation between the indoor game and the outdoor game. And many, many people don't know that we've had in our league numerous sellouts this year. We've had incredible playoffs with big crowds in Buffalo and Central Canada and Calgary and Denver. How do we, our biggest challenge is connecting that indoor product, which is just spectacular to watch from a fan experience standpoint. How do we overcome that challenge of connecting the indoor game with the outdoor game? Because there's a wide divide. And I have my new digital marketing agency here and my new growing front office staff. This is a question we have to ask. So I open it up to all three of you.
Thanks for the question, Nick. It's an interesting challenge. I think about a number of questions. How much are you talking to those owners? How much do your schedules either complement or conflict with one another? Have you seen the benefit of, or could you justify cross promotion? I'll go back to my database. Go back to my database point is, fragmentation is a challenge for a smaller but promising and high growth industry. You got to get rid of fragmentation as quickly as possible. Could data sharing and kind of co-marketing types of things create win-win opportunities for everybody? Is there any cross-ownership opportunities? So create a model where, hey, man, here it is. It's working in this town, or it's working between these two cities. So I don't know if I have any answers, but I definitely have questions.
But building on what Howard said, we're 100 years old this year. The first 97 years of the PGA, those other entities in the PGA all kind of just floated around, never really got in a room with a purpose. Right. So there were conversations and there was dialogue, but there was never a purpose. When we finally got together and said, all right, these 88 programs, let's identify the 5 or 6 things that can make a difference, sustained difference over the next 10 years, that's where change happened. And so I think you're going to have the conversations. It's, can you get in a room with a long-term plan and a purpose? Back to the things that Howard was talking about, the executional deliverables off that will come, but you have to get in a room with a purpose to say, here's how we can grow our sport. And I think if you do that, we certainly put some egos aside at the door and went in, and we're seeing the benefits of that now 3 years later.
Thanks, guys. That's the multi-million-dollar question.
Absolutely. One more time, thank you, fellas. We really appreciate it.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Great job.
Thank you very much.
Really good job. Great job. Thank you. Really good
job. Inside Lacrosse Podcast.